Hello, my name is Jordan Roger and I'm Director of Behavioural Science at Ezra. And I welcome you to Ezra Asks, where each episode we invite a special guest and leading thinker in to help us grapple with a question relevant to the worlds of personal and professional development. And today our question is there really a formula for high performing teams? As we try and answer that question, we'll dip into others. We'll try and think about, is there this secret source that all teams could potentially tap into? What factors are most important in driving team cohesion and performance? And what does diversity, friction, and the role of the leader have to do with all of this? And to help us answer at least some of these questions, we have the pleasure and privilege of being joined by Vijay Pendekar. Welcome, Vijay.
Pleasure to be here, Jordan.
So just to intro you a bit here, Vijay, you're an expert on leadership, team dynamics, and peak performance, having held senior roles at the likes of Salesforce and Dropbox. You're the author of a soon-to-be-released book, The Alchemy of Talent, which shares insights into how to lead teams to peak performance. You're a thought leader, speaker, consultant on how organizations can harvest diversity within teams to drive innovation and success. You're a very valued member, I can tell you, of Ezra's advisory board. And according to your ex-social media page, you love guitars, single malts, 90s hip-hop and rock, along with your wife and kids, and not necessarily in that order. So Vijay, welcome again to the show.
I'm completely busted. Yes. All of those things. But for posterity, wife and kids, and then okay. The guitars, the single malt whiskey, the hip hop, the rock and roll.
Okay. You kept them at the end of that list, I think, just to keep us guessing on your interest. So quite a list of roles you've played in your career and accolades you have there. So I'd love to hear briefly from you, Vijay. What brings you here to Ezra Studio to help us grapple with this question today on high performing teams?
Well, Jordan, first of all, huge pleasure to be with you today. Excited to have this conversation. And I love just the through line of, right, is there really a formula for high performing teams? I think for me, what brings me to the question is the role that being a team member has played in my life. Obviously, my work is on team leadership. But at first, before I was a team leader, I was a team member, right? And I was actually thinking about when was my first memory of being on a team. And in elementary school, I played Dungeons and Dragons and I was on a team, right? There was a group of us, wizards and rogues and priests and fighters on a campaign together. This was a team, right? It was my first experience of being part of something where it was us with a shared goal and we needed to be creative, collaborative, helpful, supportive in order to be successful. And I just remember feeling alive, you know, in a really particular way in those moments. And then later in my life on sports with Ultimate Frisbee or obviously work, right? I was on teams. Mm-hmm. And like our viewers can relate to, not all the teams were as glorious as my second edition campaign in the 1980s of Dungeons and Dragons. I was also on some dysfunctional or even toxic teams at times. And one of the things I remember about being on those teams is that I would sit there in those team meetings and be going out of my mind around like, why is it working like this? Does everybody see what I'm seeing? And then I would try and like sidebar with team members and while having coffee or, you know, lunch or whatever around the office. And I'd be like, hey, have you noticed that like there's no disagreement on our team in the meetings, but we actually all disagree about these things in real life? And people would be like, yeah, I know, but whatever, what are you going to do? You know, I just put my head down and do the work. And I'd be like, no, I can't abide, you know? And so you're right, like the early signal for me around my deep interest in teams just showed up viscerally as a kid and all the way through in terms of just noticing I was different, right, than other people, where the team dynamics themselves were actually more important to me in some ways than the individual work we each managed.
Really,
does that make sense, Jordan?
Yeah, no, so like, yeah, probably like me, a bit of a introspective observer of your environment, and yeah, recognizing those dynamics, like you say, from a very early age. I wondered whether you were going into a sports team metaphor or something else, but Dungeons and Dragons, I hear the stakes are quite high at some of those games, right?
They can be. I mean, you know, when I was in fourth grade, there was a lot of reputational credibility on the line. But I, you know, I mean, I think that people go to sports all the time with teams. But for me, as like a nerd and a geek at heart, I would just have to be authentic to my story. And my first team was a Dungeons and Dragons campaign.
Great to hear. So Vijay, I'm going to ask you, put you on the spot a bit here and ask you, you might know at Ezra, we believe coaching is a superpower and that coaching helps unlock everybody's unique superpower. So I'd love to ask you up front here, what do you think your superpower is and why?
Yeah, this is, you know, I knew, you know, for the audience, I knew this question was coming and this was a bit of agony for me because it's like brag. But, you know, I was thinking about the way some of my closest friends tease me from a place of love and deep knowing. And that's always some of the truth you have in your life, right? And if you ever get into an Uber with me, Jordan, at some point in time, we're going to take an Uber ride somewhere. There's a 90% chance that I'm going to have a long conversation with the Uber driver. Because I think my superpower, as annoying as it is to some of my friends, is curiosity. I'm like really curious about people and their stories. I'm really curious about how complicated things work. And the reason that I call this a superpower and not just like a weird or slightly annoying trait at times is that it's helped me so much in networking. And so I was thinking about like, how do I translate this into value for the audience, right? Most people, and I coach too, I mean, that's why I'm part of Ezra's advisory board, right? But when I'm coaching, so many of the executives I coach and people I coach are just like, I hate networking mixers. And for me, being dropped into a room of 100 people that I don't know is, I love that experience. And people are always like, really? Like, what kind of, you know, special masochism is this? But for me, it's just an opportunity to be curious about people and to ask questions by following that scent of curiosity. And where that showed up as like real stickiness in conversation is people are so bored with usual polite facile discussion at those things. And so for me, when someone says, oh, I'm here and this is what I do, and for me, I'm just like digging in, I'm trying to understand what they do and what they're struggling with, what's great, and they're like, oh, this is different. And that's turned into opportunities for me, that's turned into, you know, new jobs at times, and then also advisory roles with organizations or speaking opportunities. So it's really been a driver of my success.
Yeah, so curiosity about team dynamics, curiosity on a one-on-one level, trying to break down those barriers, those superficial conversations that are often essential, but not necessarily the best part of networking, right? And having seen results from it. Well, I would love to ask you what some of your opening networking lines are and how you break down those barriers. But instead, I've got some quickfire questions for you, for Jay. These ones you haven't been prepared for. So just to warm us up a little bit, we'll fire through them. So going back to your ex profile, if you could only ever listen to 90s hip hop or 90s rock again, which would you choose?
Ooh, I would say 90s rock, especially as a guitar player now. A lot of my listening is very active because I'm trying to figure out what they're doing. So yeah, I would choose rock.
Okay, and makes the guitars behind your head make a lot of sense. Okay, when it comes to whiskey, bourbon, or scotch?
I've got to say scotch. My father is an immigrant from India, and I can remember many special moments when I was growing up. I wasn't drinking the scotch, but I was watching him. You know, he would have friends over and they would pour something to mark a special occasion. And when I got into scotch myself, there was this like real deep nostalgia associated with the celebration of special moments. And even still today, when I share like a text with my family about something big and wonderful that's happened, my dad will say, time to open a new single malt, you know? So there's something really special for me with scotch.
Great. And scotch is the correct answer. So I'm glad we're allowed
There's no geographic bias here, right?
Not at all. Would you rather be able to speak every language in the world or play every instrument in the world?
Oh, brother, I thought we were friends.
Let's keep it quick.
I think that I would choose language as tough. I mean, this is such a Sophie's choice, but I would think I would choose language you know, language. I literally sometimes my kids, my daughters are 6 and 8, and sometimes they'll be like, "Dad, is your job speaking to people?" Because that's what it seems like for them. And I'm like, kind of, you know. Yeah. And I mean, I'm a keynote speaker is like one of the major ways that I make my living, and like language and the ability to connect heart and mind and build bridges across culture and difference, to reskill and upskill, all of it, language is actually the medium, right? And to, you know, when I travel internationally, I'm not polylingual, right? And so then I sit there and I get really frustrated and I'm pointing at guidebooks and I'm, you know, and I'm de-skilled. And so I do think it would be pretty amazing to be able to speak all the languages.
Yeah, for sure. And if your keynotes were done through just music, you'd probably be able to convey a lot less, right?
Yeah, but I mean, what if I was the Taylor Swift? What if I was the Gen X Taylor Swift?
Hey, who knows? We'll have to get you to get that guitar out. We'll see how things go. Okay, would you rather work in a very small and intimate team or a bigger and more complex team?
At this stage of my life, like in the chapter and the season I'm in right now, I think a small and intimate team would be more attractive. I've been in and led large, complex teams, and there is some excitement to that. The kind of stimulation and problem solving I'm looking for right now, and the kind of like where I'm getting my battery recharged is in smaller and intimate, and being able to double click and, you know, even extend the metaphor, triple click into detail. You know, like really kind of like picking things apart and why, and that KPI was the wrong one for this, you know, for this strategy or tactic, you know, that kind of stuff is really electric to me right now. And it's harder to do that. That's good.
Yeah. But recognizing you might have different preferences at different points of your career there.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of performance then, you got at this a little bit already, but would you say you're better at individual or team-based sports?
Team. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I just, I wish, I mean, like there's part of me, you know, I think we always want, right, what we aren't or can't have or whatever, but I have huge respect and like serious fanboy feelings for people who are just like crushing it as ICs, you know, like as individual contributors. And there's people who are so good at that. My experience in my 20s and 30s is that every time I moved up the management chain and led larger teams, I actually did better work because more of my gifts are in leading teams than as an individual operator. Mm-hmm. And so when I was an individual operator or when I've been in roles that's really foregrounded, I'm operating, I can do it, but I'm not in my strengths. And I'm, you know, speaking to a behavioral scientist here, right? Like part of what we're trying to align around as we navigate the decades of our careers is how do I put myself in a place where my strengths and my happiness are, you know, the slalom poles, right? That I'm steering my career between. And so for me, moving up, if you will, you know, in one sense of up, you know, in leading larger teams, I just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm actually in a flow state. Like I'm doing more with less drain, less fatigue. I'm getting more rewarded. I'm getting more, like fours and fives on the Likert scale of the evaluation, you know, things like that happen.
Yeah.
So I know I'm a team sport person.
Interesting, yeah. There's something in being a maverick, isn't there? But then there's something in surrounding yourself by people who can kind of cancel out your development areas or weaknesses, you know, that's
of which I have so many, Jordan.
Absolutely with you on that. So this is a great segue then into what is our hot topic of today. And I just want to say I've been hearing the word team effectiveness more and more often. And I'm sure for many of our listeners it's top of their agenda when it's, you know, what are you really working at in your organization? So I know you're going to bring us some very great insights on that and look forward to getting into them. Just before we really hit that big question, Vijay, I'd love you to take us through a little bit of your backstory. So I know you've worked in academia and through working in large corporations and into now, you know, doing a lot more on that thought leadership keynote front and of course, producing your book. So I'd love for you to just take us back a little bit and help us understand your journey and what led you to write The Alchemy of Talent?
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. I mean, it's an honor to be able to share some personal story before we get into team effectiveness and, you know, the behavioral science of peak performance at work, which is, I know, going to be the rest of our discussion. Mm-hmm. When I think about the through line or the trying to bring some coherence to the a life, right, and a journey, if you look at my LinkedIn, it's a highlight reel, and I always want to name, right, with real authenticity and vulnerability, that like that's not the story. Those are some highlights on the journey, and the story is, like most humans, just a hot mess of trying to sort through the fog of war and, you know, making a lot of mistakes, learning as I go. I have a squiggly career. I do not have a linear career. Every step of the way, there's been real peaks of excitement and victory, and then real valleys of self-doubt and frustration and, you know, calling friends and loved ones and being like, oh my gosh, I don't know if this is going to work, right? So, you know, I spent 18 years as a university administrator and social scientist working on environments. And so I think this is something, a passion you and I share, right? Is what I was working on is the way that students experience the university environment and how that actually has a massive either tailwind or headwind effect on their student performance. Universities look at all these different metrics of student performance. One obvious one is GPA or your grades.
Yeah.
Another one is how many credits you're completing every term. Another one is timely graduation, right? These are metrics, right? But they're actually kind of they're down the signal chain of where the actual crucible of performance is. And in the moment of how humans experience learning environments, there's all of our cognitive capacity. There's whether we studied for the test and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's also the environmental layers of, is the environment set up for you to be able to come to a genuine and strong sense of belonging? Do you feel psychologically safe in your classroom environment? Do you have adults who look and sound and talk like you in roles of authority and responsibility in this school mm-hmm. system? You know, mm-hmm. those kinds of things are called non-cognitive factors in geek language, right? They have a huge impact on how students actually perform. So this was my work for almost 20 years at 5 universities in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I moved around and writing and teaching and publishing and working in the laboratory of these universities to restructure things so that students have a more fair and equitable experience in attaining those, you know, downstream targets of grade point average and timely graduation. And then I moved into a corporate career as an environmentalist, if I can actually malappropriate that term, of the employee experience ecosystem, right? Yeah. So humans in the world of work, it's the same thing. We have these key performance indicators and these performance evaluation metrics, right, for our productivity as people and as teams, right? If you aggregate this, you can see these same things to a team effectiveness grid or dashboard. But there's all these non-cognitive factors that show up around how we do either the best work of our lives or something less than that. And we've all had moments where we're crushing it and we can think back and see that there was actually some secondary inputs in that space, and where we've had moments where we've worked really hard and things have not worked out. And that's because performance isn't as linear as pure effort. There's this environmental membrane where the behavioral psychology sits and the kind of group lateral and top-down dynamics all play out. And so that's what I worked on in publicly held corporations, all tech companies. You'll hear me using a lot of tech company language over the course of our time here, because that's the sector I've spent the most time in. Mm-hmm. And then in my newest season, I launched my own business. And now I work in a couple of different capacities, as a keynote speaker, as an author, as a thought leader and you know, knowledge producer. And then I also work in a number of advisory and fractional leadership roles. So that's how you and me get to work together because I'm an advisor with Ezra and I'm an advisor with several other companies. And I also do fractional leadership and consulting work for universities and corporations as well.
That's a great summary of a long and varied career. Thank you for helping us piece that together. And like, you know, how you started talking about childhood curiosity to how you've moved to studying those different environments in an academic and a professional sense, it So you think you're well equipped to help us answer this big question that we've got today here, Vijay. So I'm gonna hit you with what is on the surface perhaps a simple question, but one that we'll take the rest of the time we've got today to answer. So is there really a formula for creating high performing teams, and does it really work?
Oh, we're starting with the easy stuff. So when I hear the question, is there a formula for creating high performing teams? Mm-hmm. I think that the most effective and genuine answer I can bring to this is that there are formulaic elements that do matter. And I would call these like chemical inputs in a high performing team. And context is everything. So when people talk about a formula, you end up in the same tricky and sort of minefield laden space of best practices, yeah. Right? And when organizations look to best practices and they implement them in what I, as an operator, I would call lift and shift. A lift and shift is when you take a best practice. So let's say you're at a 300 person startup and you go, hey, you know what Google did?
Yeah.
And you're like, let's just do exactly that thing. There's some contextual differences between the 300 person startup and what Google does, right? And so lift and shift and with best practices has often resulted in lackluster outcomes at best, sometimes complete disasters, a lot of wasted energy and budget. And so I always want to be deferential to context being deterministic, right? I mean, you cannot ignore the context. When I was looking into high-performing teams, and we'll talk a little bit more, you know, about that why here, right? But most of us do our work on teams, and I wanted to bring forward something that was really relevant to what the world needs right now. And when I was looking into the huge body and multi-decade-long body of research on high-performing teams, one of the things I saw is that there actually are behavioral science factors that transcend most contexts. And so my book, The Alchemy of Talent, and my approach to high-performing teams is to really index off of factors that tend to be not just about the context, but actually about how humans flourish, regardless of context.
Yeah.
How we implement those factors is absolutely contextual, right? Got so when I'm coaching teams on team effectiveness, when I'm keynoting, I always talk about there's the factor and how we translate that into skill. And how we translate that into skill and leader behavior is deeply contextual. Mm-hmm. And that's what is not agnostic. But what is agnostic to the human experience is the behavioral science toolbox. Humans do better work on high trust teams. I feel very confident in saying that that cuts across almost every context I can find data on. And there's many statements like that that really stand up that are sort of context agnostic. But how you then create and sustain trust is extremely context specific.
Got you. So thinking back to that word formula and another word we've mentioned, alchemy, which is part of the title of your book. I'm hearing from you. Yeah, there might be those chemical ingredients, but when it comes to formula, we're not saying you add, you know, one pipette of A and a small dash of B and you get this outcome of peak performance. The context part, the alchemy part, the, you know, the magic tap with a wand or whatever it might be is so key to getting it. So key, absolutely. So there may be a formula. It has certain ingredients, and a huge one of those is context.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'd love you to just start to give us an idea. Maybe help us lay down some key concepts or definitions that feature in your view on reaching peak performance. And then, let's dig into each and see where we go.
Yeah, let's do it. You know, I think the one that I'm excited to talk about with you today and let's get started with is, if you, I know you have a copy of my book, but if you dig in, I think people may, after they read the preface where I talk about the context that I wrote the book to, which is disruption. And that came from talking to every business leader I know and looking at my own life and looking at what the last 5 years has served as an unlimited buffet of, which has been disruptive change. And so the Alchemy of Talent is purpose built for the context of disruptive change. And what I start with is the first factor and that factor is friction. So if you want, I can sort of unpack why friction and why does it matter for a team leader, and you want me to dig in?
I'd love to hear, yeah, how you define friction.
Yeah. And it might catch people off guard, right? As they're reading the book, I didn't think he would start here. So the logic model is this. When I was looking at the consistent evidence-based research going back decades now on teams that consistently innovate, even when they're in a very tough context, what I found was very strong, high significance evidence that teams that consistently innovate have a lot of friction. And what that means is that they have the jostling of different perspectives, approaches, ideas, ways of knowing, doing, being, that turn into a refinement model, right? So if you and I, Jordan, are working on a project together, we have all of these differences we bring into that project. And if we have the skill and the safety to actually disagree with each other productively, our end product is better. And I think that this is actually quite obvious, right, to everybody in the world of work, is that friction makes ideas, solutions, and processes better. But when you start to actually go beyond that kind of top line analysis, what you see are two things. One, that diverse teams actually have human difference as an inbuilt form of friction, right? And so when I was looking at the research on teams that are able to hit that friction flywheel more quickly, one of the things that showed up is diverse teams are able to hit that friction flywheel more quickly. And immediately you get into the noise surrounding the word diversity.
Yeah.
Because right now, we're cutting this episode in 2024, yeah, in the last few months of 2024. Unfortunately, this word is loaded with noise. That means that people hear the word and their mind goes in a variety of different places based on life perspective, political values, what media you're taking in. And that means the word is not as useful right now. I'm a pragmatist at heart.
Yeah.
And so for me, what I did is I actually take the reader through how a team leader can refactor the word diversity as complexity. Mm-hmm. We need complexity on our team because complex teams are able to solve complex problems.
Yeah.
And the innovation-focused teams that I work with, which is most world-class companies and organizations, they face complex problems, right? And so complexity as a refactoring of human difference, right? Every human brings a variety of differences into the team, and those aggregate up to complexity. This is an amazing on-ramp for friction. The second leg of the stool, though, is that friction without these other catalysts, to go back to our chemical analogy that we'll keep repeating here, right? There are catalysts that actually turn friction into productive. We've all been in rooms where we're just yelling at each other and finger pointing, or when people say, hey, I want some strongly held ideas to come forward here. And one person kind of like drops the, you know, like the hammer of like, I believe, and nobody feels comfortable enough to even challenge. Well, that's not productive friction. And so what shows up in the research in order to find the most simple flywheel I could for teams that outperform in constant disruption is, you need friction. Diversity is a great way to get there. And you need a couple of catalysts to turn it into productive friction. And the three that I chose are trust, belonging, and connection. And the reason I did is because they hold up across so many different contexts. I couldn't find a context in which human belonging didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So I tried to boil it down into the simplest model possible, because the other thing we know about disruption is that you can't hang on to comply to like, you know, here's 72 points in a team leader guide. You know, when I was talking to HR operators that I know well, and they were saying, well, our team effectiveness guide involves, you know, these like 50, you know, things that we want team leaders to remember. And it's sort of like, well, you know, when you're going through disruption, you can hang on to about two or three things.
Yeah.
And they would kind of look at with resignation. And I'm like, I know the human brain is a scintillating and also frustrating place. And so radical simplicity has to be the design principle, mm-hmm, if we're going to actually change behavior. Mm-hmm. And so the model is a very much like a less is more kind of an approach to leading through disruption. And it starts with friction as a driver of innovation.
Yeah. So just to replay some of that there. So this idea that friction's essential for innovation. Mm. And I loved how you coined that then, that I guess the next idea being diversity equals complexity. It's a different way of thinking about diversity, right? You say diversity is a very loaded term, even complexity, you know. Hey, do you fancy doing this really complex project? I'd be like, well, is there a less complex one? But it's an interesting idea. There's factors that we differ on, and this diversity between us means we're gonna have, you know, these differences playing off in all sorts of directions. And diversity then bringing, like you said, a sort of inbuilt. It's an inbuilt friction, like a flywheel for friction.
That's right. That's right.
And then, I really want to get into the three elements there. But I wondered, like, so having, as you said, received a copy of your book and had the pleasure of reading that and looking, you know, really digging into this idea of diversity, complexity, friction, innovation. I wonder if you've had any friction when probably in the negative sense when presenting these ideas to others, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, I think whenever, if you don't face any friction when you're introducing new thought leadership, it means that you haven't taken enough risk, right? Frankly. Right. I mean, you know, water is wet. No one's going to push back, you know? So in taking on the risk of trying to advance a different approach to high performing teams than the traditional models, and starting with this idea of repackaging diversity as friction, I've met resistance in two different ways. One piece of resistance, and I want to honor both of these, right? Because friction is good.
Yeah.
One piece of resistance is, hey, look, there's a lot of noise surrounding diversity right now. And simply abandoning diversity as a driver of social restoration and social justice is not actually going to help with social movements that need the constant attention to drive increased pathways to human dignity. And that pushback is valued and heard in the world of work, where we're in for-profit companies that don't have a social purpose element to their reason for being. I need to find a ROI-based form of diversity, right? A return on investment, where the leader goes, yeah, I'm going to get into this. I'm going to do this because there's a what's in it for me. And when you can help leaders, and I've done this hundreds of times, rethink about diversity actually as complexity on their team, all of a sudden there's a what's in it for me, because now they say, oh, great. If I actually am able to bake in more complexity and harness that as a driver of innovation on the team, then I will do better work. We will win more often. And that kind of self-interest-based change theory, I think, is very reasonable and effective in most organizations. And I also think that in the broader social arena, that we should not let go of the relationship between the word diversity and the reality that there are groups of people who have been demographically labeled and then excluded using those labels historically and presently. And if we don't do something to get in the game and fix those problems, then you don't get social progress, right? So I want to be very clear and name that. Another piece of pushback I've gotten is actually really good. It's, wait, you keep saying radical simplicity, and then complexity is a driver of your model.
It's a bit of an oxymoron.
it's like facepalm, right? But this is where language is so important. Complexity is not the same thing as complicated. And we're not good at this as human beings, right? And part of my job as a thought leader and a speaker is to help here, right? So complexity is inherent. In any human system, complexity is already there. Complicated is when we make it harder, right? By our 49, you know, our 7 rows and 7 columns of what it takes to be an effective team leader, or just unclear OKRs and KPIs. If you've ever worked on a team where the goalposts keep changing around what success looks like, I'm sure you've had that experience in your life. I have too. It's demoralizing, right? That's complicated.
Yeah.
Complexity is always there. The question is, what are you going to do? And that's actually one of the sort of first principles of what I've done in the design of this model is, look, it's there. Are you going to actually harness it to create a flywheel for innovation? Or are you going to actually let it be the thing that bogs your team?
Yeah, Really interesting. Complexity, but not meaning complicated. And, you know, you get at the diversity, the sort of the internal factors there, and how, you know, that one reason, you know, in leveling the playing field, if you like, for people is to talk about the things we're going to talk about today, and how you can help everyone be their best selves. But I think a challenge a lot of behavioral scientists and people in HR and sort of the talent space face is being able to communicate ideas like we're discussing in a way that CEOs can make sense of, right? So you talk about diversity, well, my head's going this way and that way. You talk to me about complexity, I'm a CEO, I know what that means, right? So it's just meeting people with that language where they are. That's
right. You know, Jordan, one of the toughest things in writing the book, you know, just to kind of get underneath the hood a little bit, if there's any aspiring authors or authors who, you know, are going to watch and listen, it's writing a book is hard, right? You have to make a lot of choices. And one of the key choices is, who is my reader? And if you don't answer that question, then you end up with a very incoherent manuscript, right? And so I made the choice to have my reader be the average team leader, person who's been given a team of 5-6 people. They didn't think they were going to be a team leader. They haven't been in all of the training programs, right? Because I wanted to have the greatest utility for the book, to help the regular person lead a team. The language in the book is extremely approachable. There's lots of like interesting illustrations and graphs and charts that allow the reader to make sense of it and turn it into a reference book that just sits on their desk. But having held numerous VP and C-level roles in complex organizations and been C-suite facing and board facing multiple times, I also had, I just couldn't let it go that the HR leadership needs the cheat sheet on how to make the business case for change. So throughout the book, every chapter actually has a section on, here's how you make the ROI, the return on investment business case for adopting this model and these approaches. Because what I hope is that the VP for talent development grabs the book and goes, yep, this is, I'm gonna change the way I'm communicating about this with the executive layer, so that we get buy-in in ways that actually are about business success, rather than, oh, HR is coming through with another touchy-feely thing, hand-wavy, you know, we need to be nice, you know. And it's like, no, these are actually performance investments that have measurable outcomes. And here's the evidence from other businesses that I feature in the book that this drives profitability, the glorious P word, and that it drives measurable team success.
Yeah.
And so that's in there for the change management leaders that need to actually speak to the business leadership and rethink the language, so that we get out of the HR space and into the effective teams are successful and they lead to profitable organizations. Full stop.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And having that toolkit, I'm sure many people wish that was currently on their bookshelves. You have to give us a little tease of the release date as we get through the episode.
Yeah.
While that brings us to the end of part one of this episode, Vijay, my head is whirring with all these great ideas we've begun to explore, as I'm sure our listeners are. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to episode two. I don't know about you.
Oh, I'm all for it. This is going to be great.
Great stuff. We'll talk again soon.